Ladies and gentlemen, it is just gone 12:15, so I believe we should resume. Now, I did indicate just at the tail end of that agenda item that there was a point with a bearing on international obligations that had emerged from oral submissions that I did just want to throw out and ventilate. I suspect that in doing so, we will probably not get a detailed and robust answer in the here and now. And so what I'm going to propose as a starting point is that we join responses to it onto the action list, and that we ask again for legal submissions on this point. Now, I'm conscious that one of the matters that we end up having to address is the standing of shipping lanes and or channels in international law in terms of UNCLOS, and also the role of the IMO, and that in that respect also there has been made reference by the applicant to compliance with IMO formal safety assessment guidelines, MEPC 2 Circular 12 Revision 2. Now, this all kind of focuses down on a point which is, I think it will be very useful to us to understand where matters around the status of a channel or a shipping lane, or indeed a piece of guidance formed by the IMO, is something that proceeds from the IMO as an international organization. Are we looking at formal requirements of international law, international treaty obligations, or are we looking at things that are somehow subsidiary to and are advisory or form guidance to us in relation to that? The reason why that is quite important to us in terms of national infrastructure casework is, again, I'm returning us to the words in the operating section of the Planning Act of 2008 as amended, section 104, where, amongst other things, if we look at 104 subsection 4, the Secretary of State is guided, amongst other things, to decide the application in accordance with any relevant national policy statement, other than in circumstances where it would lead the United Kingdom to be in breach of any of its international obligations. Now, to the extent that the IMO is an international body that we are a member of by treaty, there is clearly an international obligation in force. And we are looking to your submissions and guidance on the degree to which subsidiary matters that cascade out of the role of the IMO and our subscription to it are international obligations that bind us in terms of the Planning Act of 2008, Section 104. Now, I do note that MCA are asking to address us on this point. Very briefly, please, because I do think that the best way forward with this will be for you all to give careful consideration, seek internal legal advice if needs be, and then come back to us in writing at deadline 3. Is there anything particular that you would like to add right now?
Rakesh Pandit, MCA. Not to add to what we have spoken before the break, sir. Yes, agree that we. I think it's useful for us, for all, to have by deadline 3 written submission about the UNCLOS IMO roles, especially the subsidiary ones that you elucidated. And besides just the sea lane or international sea lane argument, I think here the main point that's still being discussed is the safety of navigation per se. So whether it's international sea lane or not, or whether the international sea lane is somehow constricted or otherwise, the ships will still use that passage. That's what I'd like to say, sir. And we look forward to providing clarity, and we will discuss with our UNCLOS experts and UNCLOS legal team, sir, and then we will provide a written statement as you instruct. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. And clearly, you know, we are going to have full regard to navigation safety matters across the piece, but because of the way the legislation is constructed, we have to make sure that we satisfy the decision-making requirements of Section 104 of the Planning Act of 2008, and we must give appropriate weight and therefore advice to the Secretary of State as directed by that section. So that's why this is important, and the best attention that your organisations can give to providing us with views on those points and would be much appreciated, and if that can be captured for the action list as well. Now, again, just before we move on, only just a very brief reference in passing that the Tilbury 2 decision has now been made. I know that there is at least one interested party in the room interested in that. If we then can move on. So, Mr. Owen.
So may I just make a couple of very quick points? I was going to mention the Tilbury decision, and I should go on to say it's been approved as opposed to the decision just being made. important distinction. Which is clearly good news for the Port of Tilbury. I wanted to, just in relation to the MPS reports, I think in actual fact there's little, if any, difference between us and the applicant on this. I think the key point for you to bear in mind is that you and the Secretary of State have a large degree of discretion because it's what you consider important and relevant. And if you look at the MPS reports, it's quite clear from it that it deals with, yes, decision-making criteria for deciding on port DC applications, but it has a lot of other stuff in it that is said to be of wider application and relevance. So we maintain our view that it is important and relevant. It's not in that at the top of the hierarchy for the reasons I explained and which Mr. Lioness agreed. And I think particularly in the context of expansion of ports now with Tilbury 2 and also the ongoing ramping up of London Gateway, it is important and relevant. So that will be our submission. The second point, sir, you asked for legal submissions on paragraph 2.6.161 of EN3. We certainly are planning to sort of slightly broaden those submissions to actually deal with the whole tiered approach, as Mr. Lioness referred to it. I think you would find it helpful if we were to do that.
No, I think that's actually a very useful point, and I think it's worth embroidering that action by actually inviting everybody around the table, not just to look at the single paragraph singularly, but to actually look at the tiered policy framework.
I think that's right, because you've got the three paragraphs, 161 to 163, clearly are tiered. I readily can appreciate they're not always as clear as one might wish them to be in terms of quite what they mean, and I would, I mean, we will put this in our note, but paragraph 162 itself, which the second tier, if you like, does actually have a number of different components to it, and I think the point Mr. Lioness is making about the interpretation of one of those components doesn't necessarily mean that other components in that paragraph 162 don't apply. For example, it separately refers to approaches to ports in a way that I don't think is related to what is meant by the next phrase about strategic routes, essential to regional, national, and international trade. So we will deal with that in our submission, which I hope you'll find helpful. And thirdly, and again, I just register the point now, and we can deal with it in submissions if you would prefer. We didn't really go on to talk about the marine policy statement position.
Indeed, we didn't. If And I think that it's important to allow space for that to occur if there are particular matters that you wish to draw our attention to. I mean, it is clearly operating law that we are, A, required to deal with it, and that, B, it has equivalent standing in broad terms to an NPS.
Yes.
And do you want to point up
particularly? So just really briefly, I think there is the UK Marine Policy Statement, and then there are two relevant plans under that. One is a draft plan, the Southeast Marine Plan, in draft as I understand it, and one is the East Marine Plan. And the East Marine Plan, I think, does have some relevant, well, both that and the draft plan have relevant provisions in, but if I just, for these purposes, look at the adopted East Marine Plan, I'd refer you particularly to paragraph 344, which refers to the East Inshore Plan area being home to a number of ports that are of national strategic importance to the UK, and these ports, as well as the importers and exporters that rely upon them, need safe navigational access to remain available with capacity to accommodate growth. And then there are some policies, PS1, PS2, and PS3, that are all relevant. PS1 says that proposals that require static sea surface infrastructure or that significantly reduce underkeel clearance should not be authorized in International Maritime Organization designated routes. PS2, proposals that require static sea surface infrastructure that encroaches upon important navigation routes, see figure 18, should not be authorized unless there are exceptional circumstances. It goes on to say that proposals should comply with a number of criteria, including being compatible with the need to maintain space for safe navigation, avoiding adverse economic impact. And policy PS3, proposals should demonstrate in order of preference that they will not interfere with current activity and future opportunity for expansion of ports and harbours. And so I'll just point out a selection of those. We can all obviously put that in writing for you. But I thought I didn't want to leave this agenda item without just picking up on that, because it is important, I think.
Thank you very much. Mr. Linus, briefly.
Scott Linus for the applicant. I think the easiest way to deal with this, as Mr. Owen suggests, is to pick it up as part of the written submissions, because the aspect of the Marine Policy Statement does also refer to important navigation routes and so on, so there is some degree of overlap between the consideration of the NPS and the paragraphs in the NPS. Mm. That's probably the best way of dealing with that.
Yes. Well, again, I will further embroider the action, yes, then, drawing it even wider and asking those folk interested in this also to address relevant Marine M, not NPS, policy, and then also to turn their attention to both draft and adopted marine plans and the policies therein. Is there anything else we need to touch on before we move on to agenda item 4? No, thank you very much. Now, here I am going to hand lead on this matter to my colleague, Mr. Bradley, who will take you through that item.
Thank you. I'm now going to start by asking the interested parties if they would like to summarise, in addition to any statements they've already made, their position since having the benefit of the applicant's responses at both deadlines 1 and 2. Now, section 4 here is a complicated section, and do recognize that there's interaction between all of the sub-items. But I think what we therefore probably can do is to take section 4 as a whole to start with, and then we'll come back to dissect and focus on specific subsections later on. We'll then come back to ask the applicant to respond. And whether you want to respond to the whole or to the individual, I leave it up to you.
Okay, thank you.
So, to get the ball rolling, I think, may I first turn to MCA, please, and THLS. If you wish to collaborate and would certainly make it clear whether you're supporting or enhancing each other's responses, that will be, I think, very useful to us. But if we could ask you to state any particular additional points you want to make about the Navigational Risk Assessment, the NRA, the inputs to the NRA, the conclusions from the NRA, and in particular starting with looking at aspects of engagement with stakeholders and with experts. What we're primarily looking for here is to understand which parts of the guidance on risk assessment, and particularly the methodology of risk assessment, are subject to discretion. Because I think what we're really trying to test in this section of the agenda is the position that we've heard earlier of the NRA having some deficiencies, but as yet the applicant waiting to hear proper evidence of what those deficiencies are. And then I think later on we come on to what can we do about any deficiencies if they are acknowledged.
Yes.
Okay. So, MCA first, please.
Rakesh Pandit, MCA. Thank you for the floor, sir. Although we don't have any particular statements to make over and above what we already said, I would like to apprise the XA team and everyone that we have had within the margins of this meeting, we have had a number of liaisons with the applicants, and we have made our formal and informal positions known to them on the submissions as we have received so far, even after the second deadline. I think, as we had said earlier, it's hard to put some sort of numerical number or in order to mitigate or in order to provide a line that this could be the NRA go-to area. It's difficult, and neither the guidance MGN 543 purports to it. That it merely provides a framework, a methodology or template, as it were. And based on that, NRA is produced. Just because NRA is produced based on that doesn't imply that the risk is acceptable, tolerable, or mitigated enough. Yes, sir, that's about all I can, or MCA could say at this stage. Thank you.
First, THLS, is there anything you'd like to add?
Trinity House, Roger Barker. Working closely with the MCA and indeed the applicant on the NRA, we do accept or note the NRA, but the major concern with the proposed extension is that although we do note the NRA, the decision on is the risk presented by the extension tolerable is the key question.
I would just interject that there's a sub-item here where I think you can spend a substantial amount of time on that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So your question, did you want to overarch
an overview at the moment, and then we'll come back and examine that specifically.
Okay, so with regard to the NRA and the quantification of the risk laid down in the NRA, we note the NRA and no further comment other than what my colleague from the MCA has noted. But I would draw the attention to in the NRA, because it is pertinent, I think, to the questions about the National Policy Statement. And paragraph 8.7, page 127 of the NRA, is a summary. and it states, the risk assessment has demonstrated that the proposed Thanet extension would increase the navigational risk for vessels near to the development. I think it's a major statement, and at your request, I will cover the elements of risk assessment further under the agenda item F of the agenda item 4 more substantially.
Thank you. Can I just ask for that paragraph reference again, because it slipped me by as you went into the content of it.
Paragraph 8.7, page 127 of the NRA.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Perhaps the easiest way is to continue round the table, actually, and then I think, if I may, I'll just ask if the port's got anything to add. But firstly, is there anything from HMCG, from the Coast Guard?
Not really, other to Tony Evans from HM Coast Guard. Not really to add further than my colleague from MCA has put forward. Clearly, there was some concern that we disputed or said that the process had not been followed properly, which was referred to in our written statement that we didn't dispute that you'd followed the process, but we didn't necessarily agree that the content fully displayed some of the risks that were there, which we discussed at the last meeting. And obviously, we're just highlighting the concerns from interested parties on this side, and I understand that you do require us to provide evidence to support that, and hopefully during the discussion today that will come out.
Thank you for acknowledging that. Chamber of Shipping.
Fella Boyle, UK Chamber of Shipping. Thank you, sir. We have nothing further to add on this point at the moment. Thank you.
PLA?
It would be useful for us to pick up just the question of whether there was adequate stakeholder engagement in framing the questions about the NOA. There was very limited engagement with ESL and the PLA on this. The simulator study in which ELA participated, that a couple of weeks after that simulator study, the ESL were issued with a draft of the study saying that the applicant would be in touch to discuss wider issues. And that was in the summer of 2017. In December 2017, Marico got in touch to say that they were drafting the NOA. And then that's more or less the end of it. There were limited subsequent meetings with the PLA and ESL, but none that dealt with the content of the NOA. The PLA and ESL have spent considerable time and effort in providing extensive explanations for the benefit of the applicant in their written submissions as to the ways in which the pilot transfer bridge simulation and the NOA are deficient and the issues with how MGN 543 have been addressed. And it is, frankly, disappointing to be told that that is not enough, but so far that does seem to be the approach that the applicant is taking, and it is, after all, far easier to say that they need more information and do nothing than to begin to address the deficiencies that have been highlighted. So we would like to see some feedback from the applicant on that addresses these deficiencies.
Thank you. Thank you. And LPC?
Yes, sir. With regard to the NRA, it's my opinion that the report suggests practices such as routing large vessels, which are constrained by the draft, to transit the northeast spit over the bank. And this, insofar, completely ignores IALA voyage protocol and other navigation aids which are in place to assist safe navigation. There are other issues regarding passage planning, which we'll come to further down in the agenda. But the report essentially also advocates reducing the size of the Margate Roads anchorage, or even moving the Margate Roads anchorage, which it's a safe anchorage, it's a safe haven for southwesterly winds. 5, 6, or 10 vessels a day are in there. We have plenty of detail to support that. The sea room obviously is reduced by 50%, and the trials they used for large vessels were all done at a very preferable state of tide, all at high water. So it doesn't represent in actual what happens in practice where we board and land pilots in all states of tide and weather. We'll probably come to it in a little bit later in more detail, but the PLA simulator is severely restricted in terms of being able to produce the detail and level of results that you would want to see to believe that this was possible. For instance, we were unable to produce the existing wind farm. They have to do it by sticking oil rigs in the way. Simulator test itself, the pilots who were involved were all senior hands who've been there some very, very many years. Down at the Northeast Spit, most of the pilots there are Class 4, Class 3, Class 2 pilots. They've been there from 1 year to possibly 5 years in the role. They are the less experienced pilots, and we're putting them at serious risk with the reduction in sea room. The pilot boat itself in the NRA, in the simulator test, was substituted by a tug. And as I say, whilst the speeds could be replicated, the tug simulator doesn't have a radar. So it's beyond belief how you manage to then be able to conform with coal regs, use ARPA, because there's so much traffic down there, it doesn't have AIS. And you're relying totally on radar to plot that to avoid risk of collision. Plus the fact that when you're in restricted visibility, you need so much more sea room. And we'll go on to the sea room and restricted visibility a little bit later. And then in terms of the reduction in underkeel clearances that was discussed before, there's absolutely no allowance made for the weather. I mean, in periods of heavy swell, high winds, then we really have to put some allowance in. You can't go across banks with 1.5 metres under the keel when you've got a 3 metre swell running. You'll just slam on the bank. It's as simple as that. So, you know, there's all of these considerations which were not made in the NRA.
Thank you. Could I, if I may, just before passing to the ports, just to ask if you particularly wanted to make any observations on engagement, because that was the, if you like, the encapsulation of this early part of the section.
I think the main engagement was is I'm not sure how the tests were or the introduction was made with the Port of London for proposing the tests, but they certainly weren't run by the navigation risk assessment groups which we have at the Port of London. So we would expect another level of simulation to involve a navigation risk assessment group, and we would also have to include within that process our junior pilots who are doing that job down the Northeast Spit day in, day out.
Thank you very much. Mr. Owen.
Robbie Owen, Port of Tilbury in London Gateway. So thank you. By way of just an overview comment at this stage, as I think you've requested, as you'll remember from the first hearing, the ports weren't involved in the draft of the NRA before it was submitted. We've since employed H.R. Wallingford to look into the NRA, and Mr. Crockett to my right will just say a few words in terms of where he's currently got to and his view on the draft, if that would be helpful.
Very much, thank you.
Good morning. This is going to be a very quick overview in accordance with your request, Chair. I'll deal with the NRA first. The NRA, there's a declaration of interest I must put first to the room. H.R. Wallingford provide real-time navigation simulation services, and we've done work with Marico Marine in the past. So I just want people to be aware that when we come to talk about navigation simulation work, that we're actually provide that service. The navigation risk assessment document, it's comprehensive, there's no question. We understand what Marico do, and it's well structured. There are several difficulties with the document, though, in that the reader is possibly led astray by the relative importance of the ports, and perhaps the document has actually missed the real target, which is that this development is being expanded in the outer estuary of a major container terminal in the United Kingdom and a major port complex at Tilbury. It's, with all due respect, it's not about the port of Ramsgate, and it's interesting that there's probably more lines in the document about Ramsgate than there are about the other ports. There's no real mention of the port of Sheerness, we're getting off the subject, and there's no actual mention, I think I did word check it again, of LNG carriers, which are quite risk-averse type ships. They're special category ships, and these ships do indeed go to the northeast bit. So I think what I'm really trying to paint here is that the introductory section of the document probably needs to just point to the sensitivity of the location and the types of ships that are going round that, and that at the time that the survey was done, London Gateway was in a period of rapid growth, and that the current data indicates that there are actually very large ships passing through what I would call the inshore route. It's called the inshore passage and various things, but just call it inshore. It's not a channel, by the way. Ships of up to, well, in excess of 11,000 TEU, and I'm going to use the phrase geometric capacity here, so it's nothing to do, it's the number of boxes you can actually fit. 11,000 is not huge, but it's a very, very large ship. And a particular feature of these ships is you can no longer see the buoys. So if you put it in the simulator, the buoys are simply invisible because they are hidden by the bow. So these are large ships, and the data so far suggests that they are going through both with and without pilots. And in terms of the questions in the previous one, I think there was the phrase was used, restricted in the ability to manoeuvre. And I think that's quite an important phrase, because I actually don't know what the answer to that is. I'm not sure anybody does. And maybe that needs some careful consideration. Is it a ship that's 200 metres long? Because some ships, smaller ships, are worse than bigger ships. So I think that's probably enough on that part of it to just say we have some concerns. On the simulator bridge simulation, although a lot has been made about whether it was dusk and whether a tug was used or a pilot boat was used, I think the essential point that's being missed here is that navigation simulation is about answering the essential question, have we got enough space? And by using a ship that was only 240 metres long, when we now know, even today, we're getting ships in excess of 333 metres long, there clearly must be a difference between a ship that is 330 metres long in terms of its swept path and a ship that's only 240 metres long. There has to be a significant difference, and for that reason alone, I think really the simulation study cannot be relied on, because it's simply not giving you the correct answer, which is, have we got enough space? Also, really, if you're going to do it, and there was a hint over here just now on the other side of the room, if you are going to do it, then you probably need to consider a wider range of ships and perhaps see whether there's any special considerations for LNG carriers, which is nothing to do with Gateway or Tilbury, but it would just be good to know whether they're, and I think, as just been pointed out, not including the wind farm in the visual scene is quite an omission, because that will be quite visually important. I think that's really what I've come to on that. So quick,
thank you.
Run through and keep it brief.
I appreciate that. I think just before I ask to move on into the next agenda sub-item, I would like to just pick up on this point about the
I think we need to just
we do
refer to the
I think that this might be important for you. So can I just ask a supplementary question to MCA, I think in this point, because I see here in the, if like in the panoply of regulation here that MCA have a particular importance in taking judgment. And I think that taking Mr. Crockett's point about the adequacy of the simulation, the applicant has at a number of points in submissions between deadline one and deadline two, in both in fact, said, well, the simulation's only a part of the NRA. and it's just a component factor. I'd like to test this somewhat with the IPs and see what level of acceptance there is of that statement. Indeed, the simulation is in and of itself under scrutiny and under criticism, but how important is that to the overall importance of the NRA?
Rakesh Pandit, MCA, thank you again, sir. As far as our guidance is concerned, I'm sure, I don't remember 543, the back of my hand, but at least I know one thing, that we don't particularly state any certain means or type of study, desktop study or otherwise, or we don't particularly mention simulation as such. And yes, we also agree and we also observe that simulation study or conformance to simulation study, what the applicants have detailed, is only part of NRA. And I like that that is being called only part of NRA, because apparently what I gather from our stakeholder is that the simulation study seems to be given undue weightage or disproportionate weightage towards sort of deciding on the NRA's efficacy. So I'm glad that you brought the point that it is only part of NRA, and it is hard to sort of again give it a league table style pass mark if you've done simulation study, albeit this particular simulation study, there are a lot of questions about it across the board have been raised, including ourselves. Even if this simulation study was, say, 100%, and let's say it rivaled aviation level simulation study, I don't think that we would have been able to impart a certain pass mark to it towards the NRA, but after all, one bit of NRA.
Thank you for the analogy. Mr. Lyon, it's your turn.
Scott Lyon for the applicant. Thank you very much, sir. There are a number of detail points there which may be better dealt with at other agenda items, but can I say this at this stage? I'll deal first of all with the points raised by the PLAs regards consultation. I don't want to labour the point because we've dealt with this in Annex I and Annex J to Appendix 25 in our earlier submissions of deadline one. We don't accept the proposition that there's been inadequate consultation with the PLA, as even a cursory look at Annex I suggests there have been meetings starting in November 2016 with a pre-scoping meeting which discussed impact on pilotage. Following a scoping response in February 2017, there was another meeting in April 2017 which has minutes of Annex J, which discussed the pilotage study as well as a general discussion on traffic. And I can refer the examining authority to section 5.3 and item 6 as one example. There was a meeting in July 2017, also identified in Annex J, where the minutes are contained, where the overview of the pilotage study and discussion of the pilot simulation took place. The reference is paragraph 7.3. In August 2017, again, Annex J minutes, reference to the issuing of the pilotage study report and feedback, as well as discussion on the piloted simulation at sections 5 and 6, including discussion of the setup of the inception report and the setup day itself. The setup day took place in September 2017 for the pilot simulation. And then there was a meeting in relation to the NRA in December 2017, which discussed key navigational themes, and that's identified in page C3, Annex C3 of the NRA itself. So we say there has been extensive consultation carried out with the PLA, and the result of all that is that essentially PLA and ESL, who had similar participation in these meetings, were extensively consulted in relation to the piloted bridge simulation study. They reviewed and agreed the inception report that laid out the basis for the assessment. They provided the PLA pilot training simulator to carry out the assessment. They provided pilots of their choice to act as pilots boarding vessels. They provided the ESL coxswains to act as pilot boat coxswains. They provided pilots as simulator operators. They agreed on the findings of the simulation at what my team call a hot wash-up at the end of the simulation study. And they haven't provided any comment on the draft piloted simulation report. So the focus of their concerns appears not to relate to the extent of the consultation, but the extent to which we've accepted some suggested change to the red line boundary. We just don't accept that the extent of consultation has been inadequate.
So can I just drill into that very briefly with two secondary questions? I mean, it's essentially here your characterisation of the process is of one where the process you believe has been fully and adequately carried out, but there is clearly a residual disagreement about content. Yes. But to the extent that there is a disagreement about content, it's your proposition that because of the level of engagement with process that the relevant interested parties had, that had they had sufficient early opportunities to raise disagreement yeah. about content that might derive from method earlier in the piece than they did. So you're essentially suggesting that to the extent that there are now what appear to be very substantial technical disagreements, you are saying that they arose somewhat too late?
Yes, our Scott Lennon is the applicant. Our point is that we're to a degree surprised that concern being raised about a piloted simulation study that the PLA had involvement with at every stage, particularly in circumstances where it's their own simulation that we were using, and they had extensive consultation on how this was all going to be set up, including the setup day itself. So if there were concerns about the way in which the pilot simulation study was going to operate, we would have expected a greater degree of criticism or points being raised at an earlier stage of the process.
I think perhaps we'll yes. spend a little bit more time on it later on if
yes.
we can. I'm aware that there's a big agenda to get through, so
yes, I'm happy
I think
to move
we
on.
May have to rely to some extent on the written submissions.
Yes. That's why Scott Lennon, the applicant, I mentioned that we've dealt with this in Annex I and J, which identifies the meetings that took place. And we've dealt with this in our other responses. We don't propose to deal with it further. As for the points that were raised by H.R. Wallingford across the table, obviously we're hearing these criticisms for the first time, and to some extent we can come back to those as we go through individual sessions. I mean, I would say, though, insofar as there's concern raised about the extent to which the NRA only really looked at sort of Port of Ramsgate, obviously, in circumstances of this case, the sort of direct relationship with Port of Ramsgate had obvious relevance to the NRA, as opposed to ports which were in the region of 40 to 45 nautical miles away from the array. There are wider implications there insofar as any criticisms raised about the extent to which these parties were consulted. I don't propose to go into that because consultation has been dealt with in relation to the deadline 2 response, but we don't accept the criticism that The ports ought to have been sort of front and central in the introductory section of the NRA, given the approach that was taken and the distance from the array. We think that the relevant shipping routes were taken into account, and that's the most important factor as far as the NRA is concerned. Another point was raised about the pilotage simulation and ship size. Again, we'll come on to this in a later session of today's hearing. But I mean, we have provided information both on the ships that are using that route and through the deadline to submissions, evidence on what the reasonable maximum size of vessel using that inshore route should be. That has been drawn from other evidence that other parties have provided. The information that's come from the ports, essentially as we understand it, is information about the tonnage and the vessels that have been going to those ports, which doesn't actually assist you in understanding the size of the vessels that are using the inshore route. And we can come back to that a later session. And as for criticisms of the simulator, there was a point raised about the extent to which the wind farm was included in the simulator itself. I can say that perhaps this tells its own story, that the wind farm was not initially in the simulator and it had to be added by way of proxy additions of oil rigs, because clearly when the PLA were setting up the simulator, the extent of any concerns about the wind farm clearly hadn't made their way into having the wind farm added into the simulator itself. And that was picked up as part of the preparation in discussions with the PLA, and the applicant, through those discussions, made sure that the oil rigs were added in as a proxy for the wind farms as part of the simulation report. So we don't accept any criticism in that sense that's been raised from the other side of the room, but any more detailed points about piloted simulation or indeed sea lanes can be picked up in later sessions of this part of the agenda.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, just very briefly on a minor consequential point before we move on. Significant elements of that conversation have included reference essentially to the engagement of a level of agreement between experts in navigation risk assessment. And I did refer briefly at the end of the last agenda item to seeking some advice around IMO FSA guidance, which, again, it's not a matter of dispute that it's relevant because it's been referred to us by the applicant. One just passing comment is that, of course, that guidance is not as yet formally submitted to this examination, and in order for it to be included in the examination library electronically available and freely accessible to all parties, I just felt we needed to have that submitted.
Scott Lyons for the applicant. Would you like that identified as a formal action on our part?
Yes, please.
Yes, we'll do that. Yes. Thank you very much, sir.
Objections to asking questions?
Indeed, yes. No, a good point, because Mr. Bradley's lines of questioning further on may need to return to that. Even though that document isn't formally submitted yet, does anybody object to us referring to it and raising questions relating to it? It's freely available on the internet, and I would trust everybody around the table in this field would be more than familiar with it in advance. I would be content, unless anybody formally objects, that if Mr. Bradley wants to ask questions relating to it, that they be asked today rather than deferred. Is everybody content? And we all have screens in front of us as well, so if anybody needs to look at it, they can Google it. On that basis, we will refer to it if it crops up in Mr. Bradley's questioning.
It will right now. I'd like to pursue, and I think we've really covered A and B for the time being perfectly well. And so, subsection C, which is about the involvement of experts, the FSA guidance from the IMO does indeed say at Annex 1 that it's highly recommended to report the level of agreement between the experts in the results of a study. That's point one. And point two, which I think is linked here, that the applicant states in Rep 1024 that the expert judgment of project personnel was used in a workshop environment to review the evidential base. Now, I'm going to ask the two questions together here because I think that it's going to be time-consuming to separate them. But the first question, I'm going to ask MCA to address this one and then see if there's anybody else wishes to add anything. Firstly, would the MCA comment on whether they consider that this NRA has indeed followed the recommendations of expert involvement to a sufficient degree? And I think that's really the opening question. If it hasn't, should the NRA have followed the IMO FSA guidance in this regard? Firstly, there's an element of opinion as to whether the experts have been sufficiently involved, but secondly, have the levels of agreement been reported in the assessment? Second part is really about the expert judgment of project personnel. MCA's comment on whether project personnel only are sufficient for this type of study, or whether indeed other experts should be involved in review of the outputs of the NRA in final draft form.
Rakesh Pandit, MCA, thank you, sir. I'll be brief because a couple of questions. As it has emerged, and MCA as regulators, as you know, sir, it's our want to have involved all of the navigation stakeholders, and we have heard from the various stakeholders this side of the cubicle, where I'm not saying that we have cast aspersions on lack of adequate expert engagement, but pretty close to that. I think we all have heard that. Second thing about the IMO FSA, IMO formal safety assessment guidance, guidelines, we also make a mention of that within our MGN 543 as part of the process, because IMO FSA guidelines within this sense can only be referred to get the concept, not the actual content, because the IMO FSA guidelines are really for IMO rulemaking, like this safety of life at sea, coal reg, and so on, and IMO treaties exposition on the ships. So they are basically, so the numbers that you get from there, things like, I'm not expert on FSA, but things like GCAF or NCAF or CRADE, gross cost of averting a fatality, net cost, they are particularly designed or defined within the scope of ships and ships functions and so on.
Yeah.
And hence, the numbers can only be, or the quantitative analysis can only be approved or otherwise within that sense. So yes, FSA, like I say, we ourselves talk about the IMO FSA within our own MGN, MGN 543, but only to be a start point, not end. That is to start point to have the adequate, what the industry at, what the stakeholders considered adequate expert level engagement. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. I think the point that I'd just like to come back to then is the question of if a review of an NRA and whether in fact this is something which normally one would expect to have an independent or a level of independent review before finalization. Because I think it's that part of the evidence that we need to test. There's been quite a number of written submissions on this which seem to indicate that there has been obviously an opportunity to comment on the NRA, but the NRA as published, as opposed to the NRA in its emerging finalization. And it's, if you like, stakeholder comment rather than engagement. So would you like to give us some, I think what we're really looking for is your guidance on what you would expect to have happened to help the applicant to understand the detail of the level of objection that we're hearing around this examination.
Rakesh Pandit, MCA. I think, sir, this isn't a question I, as one person representing the whole MCA, can answer just by myself without having consulted both the MCA experts, including our legal experts, because we do say about, we do outline NRA, but we don't outline NRA processes completely in our guidance. Mm-hmm. We only provide two guidance or guidelines, and those guidelines are, at the end of the day, just that. Mm.
Can I just briefly test something there, then? Firstly, I think I can feel an action coming on. I feel that it is necessary for you to seek formal internal guidance and put a position to us in writing for the next deadline on Mr. Bradley's question. And as part of that exercise, I think it would assist the examining authority if we had a clear understanding from you as to whether external expert review stroke peer review is a discipline that would normally be expected in project level NRA for a project such as this. And also then, if that would normally be the case, do you feel that that has been adequately provided for by the consultative processes that and the engagement processes that the applicant has carried out or not? Because I guess that takes me to the final point, which is, if not, what then ought be done?
Yeah, Rakesh Pandit, MCA. Thank you, sir, I think. Thank you for your submission and very sage advice. I think we'll take the action, although my MCA team may not be happy. There are a few actions there, but I think this is a very sage at least approach to a resolution of the bits of the NRA or the whole NRA scheme that we are talking about in this context. Thank you.
Good, thank you. It does give us an opportunity to move on. In sections, and if I may, I'd like to make some progress through the items and then give you an opportunity to respond kind of as a basket of responses. Seasonality. Now, to the extent that the applicant has already responded, and I think in some detail, actually, at deadline two, to the concerns that have been raised by the IPs, both at the last hearing and indeed after the last hearing, so I'd like to clarify what outstanding concerns there are about data collection. Having expressed reservations at the last hearing, I think it would be wise to move on and see whether the IPs, the interested parties, are, broadly speaking, satisfied with the response that they've received from the applicant at deadline two. And this is particularly, I think, in regard to the traffic survey and the use of incident records as inputs to the NRA process. And I'm just going to kick the ball off with one particular point, which I feel has been a source of, let's be frank about it, has been a source of some dispute between the applicant and the IPs, and that is whether the 1 month of winter AIS data from December 2016 is or is not sufficiently representative of conditions to give a robust risk assessment. Firstly, I think we've got to look at whether the IPs are satisfied with the rebuttal the applicant has already issued at deadline two. And secondly, to move on to specifics of what's missing. If they're not satisfied, we've heard earlier on that there's an absence of acceptance in the NRA of the importance of fishing traffic and navigational traffic, and whether in fact the data used for the NRA misses important chunks of both of those elements of activity within this study area. So I think probably best to start again, if we would, with MCA and ask how important is the absence of leisure and fishing traffic, and are there still outstanding concerns with the answers from the applicant at deadline two?
Tony Evans, Coast Guard. Yes, thank you. I think the question was asked at the previous hearing when the data had been extracted. And from my memory, we were looking at April through to June, March to June for one section, and then a winter section. I think it was expressed at that meeting there was some concern that the summer period of extensive leisure traffic in the area approaching Ramsgate and the North Foreland had been missed within that data. I think it is quite significant leisure traffic through the summer months from June through to the end of August, or end of June through to the end of August, so it would impact on an overview of this area and the traffic, not purely on AIS, but also radars. Not a lot of this leisure traffic will be AIS traffic. Maybe my colleagues from ESL who spend a lot of time working in that area may want to comment on that as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other IPs who'd like to comment on the data set used for the NRA?
Vince Crockett from HR Wallingford. I think actually looking through the data, there are peaks that the container trades, for example, are well recognised as having a pre-Christmas rush, and there is evidence in the AIS data and PLA Polaris data that there is evidence of a little bit of a pickup in the container trade. As you can imagine, lots of containerized toys come in from East Asia, and corresponding to that, post-Christmas, it's not a great surprise that there's a decline in that rush, because you've met Christmas and the New Year. So that is there, but frankly, it's probably not in the same level as fishing, and particularly in good weather in the summer. I think we would submit that, yeah, there is a seasonality there. And I think the main concern about the seasonality, and it's probably not the noun seasonality that's the concern, it's probably the sampling period. In other words, we have got the situation that a ship unfortunately just went through with a big size the day after the sampling, and that's inevitable. You can't help that. If you're going to go for, you know, and we absolutely understand that, if you go for relatively short sampling periods, you're going to miss the big ship that went through, and possibly also on seasonality, but large ships, the cruise season, depending on where they are, will actually have an element of a seasonality, and these are quite large ships. So I think it's really exactly the point that's been made. It's fishing and leisure, I think, really, and perhaps recreational fishing at that, and whatever fishing season is open or closed.
thank you for that. I can feel that it might be worth jumping in with what I can anticipate as a point that's already made in the written submissions, which is that the NRA did look at the guidance here and looked at a 14-day period of AIS data, supplemented by other data sources. Would you like to elaborate that yourself before we proceed, and then we'll...
Sir, yes. I'll, Scott Linus for Vattenfall. If I may, I'll deal with this point first and then come back to the point on guidance and experts, yeah. If I may. Ed Rogers will pick up any more detailed points, but as far as seasonality was concerned, just to be clear about the information that is there, there were two periods of survey data, February 2017 and June 2017, which together gave you 28 days of survey data. And then there was separately 3 months of AIS data from the winter period of December through to February. We say that complies with Annex 1 of MGN 543, which requires a total of 28 days, which takes into account seasonal variations, and that was the purpose of the surveys being carried out specifically in the February and the June. The MGN guidance says you shouldn't rely upon AIS data alone, but we haven't done that. But we've got 3 months' data over that period. As far as this point about not picking up in particular recreational activity is concerned, the NRA. The RYA did provide information on vessel intensity, which is included in the NRA, and they didn't see it as necessary to present that information splitting between the February and the June or particular times of the year. And there's been no objection pursued on the grounds of the survey information or any other baseline information that's been presented by the applicant. So the ROA has specifically had the opportunity to consider the extent to which any of the work we've relied upon fails to reflect any difference in recreational traffic, but we haven't seen any objection. The other sort of contextual point I would raise is that obviously this information is fed into a wider NRA. And we used vessel incident and accident data that covered a period from 1997 to 2015. So it included incidents which occurred during all seasons over 18 years, and that's another important factor to bear in mind when looking at the wider assessment. And the next point is, apart from the RYA, there's been consultation with the Royal Temple Yacht Club. No concerns have been raised with respect to seasonality or presentation of information. And the MCA has said that they were happy with the data as we understood it at the earlier issue-specific hearing. So all these factors in our submission suggest that there should be no issue with seasonality and that our information is adequate. And our risk assessment, quite apart from taking into account the survey data, it shows that recreational and fishing vessel hazards were assumed to be one of the highest individual risk hazards. So it's not as if the survey data or the need to assess recreational and fishing vessels was somehow negated in importance as far as the NRA is concerned. They're amongst the highest individual risk hazards and recorded due priority in the NRA itself. So for all those reasons, we don't accept any criticism on seasonality grounds, and just wondering if Dr. Rogers had anything to add to that.
Ed Rogers for the applicant. The only thing I'd maybe add was that at the PEIR stage, the survey dates were issued within the documentation then, and at that point we got no concerns raised about the timing of the AIS and perhaps more importantly, the radar survey that was conducted between February and June.
So, if I may, the ESL did want to say something on seasonality before it passed over to the applicant, and I wondered whether now is the right time.
Indeed,
thank you. Indeed, I had a question teed up for you. In any case, so let's see whether you've anticipated it.
Yeah, Richard Jackson, Estuary Services Limited. We had flagged the traffic surveys and the survey periods and seasonality when we met to discuss the pilotage study, because when the pilotage study was presented, that only contained 3 months AIS data, because at that point the traffic survey, I think, hadn't been done or was in the throes of being done. But we don't think that the traffic survey is enough, because there's a lot, you know, there's a lot to analyse. It's a big period. I think taking the 28-day minimum of a traffic survey, and it, when it says in MGM 543 that if deemed necessary to cover seasonal variations, peak times, or perceived future traffic trends, the survey period may be extended to a maximum 24 months. So our interpretation of that is saying perhaps you should come forward and discuss, which of course every time we've asked why only 28 days, it was just really the response has generally been surveys don't tend to go beyond that. And that's kind of it, isn't it? What then happens is by the time you factor in 3 months AIS data into the NRA, you've got an NRA that's hugely biased towards AIS data, because AIS data is outweighing the traffic survey. So we're back to the same old problem that we have with the NRA is at times it's showing you what's there, but it's not showing you why. It's not showing you why traffic is behaving in that way. And then you do collision modelling, which is based on December 2016. So therefore, nothing in theory in the collision modelling that hasn't got AIS is represented in the collision modelling. So then how can you take that forward to assess risk when a substantial part of the key, like fishermen, like leisure craft, aren't in the collision modelling? So it sort of skews the perspective. I think you'd have to see a much greater traffic survey. And I think that there's a minor point. I mean, December 2016 for that year, Estuary Services for pilotage served 474 vessels. You know, how would that look different if you'd have done that same survey in May of the same year, where we served 638? You know, so the 3 months AIS data actually were generally very, very quiet. They were three of the quietest months. They were all sub 500. If you'd have taken that data from the previous 11 months, they would have all been over 500. So you start to see that not only have you got an AIS bias, it's an AIS bias that doesn't represent the full extent of the traffic. It also doesn't represent the leisure traffic that doesn't have AIS. I appreciate the RAA and the Royal Temple, but of course they're a representative body of their members. And there's an awful lot of members, or an awful lot of recreational users, that aren't associated with the Royal Temple, that aren't associated with the other. That's not, you know, that you would ignore their opinion, but there's just a large amount of people there that aren't really consulted or, you know, represented, I would say, through the NRA. So I think the periods could have been longer. I think there hasn't been any justification as to why, even though we have asked. And, you know, I think that... I think we've been quite open about the fact that throughout the studies, there are skews driven by AIS and the interpretation of that. So.
Can I just consult, if I may, with... I'm going to just consult for a moment on timing here, because we're conscious that we've really running quite close into our lunch timing. Just bear with me a moment. Do we want... There's some actions coming on here as well. And I'd quite like to capture them before we break. But it might be better to do them afterwards.
My critical concern is that even capturing the relevant actions might take another time.
Yes, I'm going to ask the applicant if you'd kindly hold response until after the lunch break. But I'm going to pass now to Mr. Smith to just do a wrap-up of this session.
Yes. We are essentially stopping at a kind of disjuncture where we are not completed on this item, and I note a number of requests to be heard on specific points that we still have not taken. But I'm just conscious that a number of people may be relying on the cafe in this building, which I believe shuts shortly. And so if you do need lunch, we do need to break now to enable you to have it. I am going to suggest that we break for an hour and that we return at 2:30. What I will just say very briefly is that in that hour, of course, you all being assembled together in the same place, if there is any productivity at all likely to emerge from conversations between various interested parties and the applicant, seeking to frame matters that might potentially begin to move away from that which is in dispute to that which might be done to narrow the parameters of dispute, I would strongly encourage some of the lunch break potentially being used for that, because I am conscious that, you know, most of these last pair of items have consisted of very broad-ranging dispute and not a great deal of focus on the degree to which there is possibility for dispute to be limited. And returning to my early remarks at the beginning of this agenda, because time is pressing against us, if some measure of redefinition and limitation of dispute is to occur, really it does need to start to occur around the next deadline point. This lunchtime might be a very useful place where minds can begin to meet if that hasn't already occurred before. So let's break. Let us resume at 2:30, ladies and gentlemen.